This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Chuck Klosterman begins his new book, I Wear the Black Hat, grappling with villains real and imagined, with some questions about himself. Does he care about strangers? Is he a psychopath? Is he evil? He even quotes his editor, who said to him when he was pitching the idea for this book, "You want to write it because you are afraid you are actually a villainous person." Chuck Klosterman writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine, was a columnist for Esquire and Spin, and now is the author of 8 books. This new one is an eclectic exploration of perceptions and presentations of evil in pop culture and in the real world. For instance, he looks at vigilantism through Batman, Bernie Goetz, and the movie Death Wish. And Chuck Klosterman joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me here.
You're very welcome. One of the things that you say in this book, in any situation, a villain is the person who knows the most but cares the least. What made you think of or make up that definition? Who were you thinking of?
Okay, well, first of all, I have to say that I mentioned this in the book. It's not a perfect sort of field theory. It's not as though this statement is absolutely impenetrable, inflexible. I mean, I talk about Hitler at the end of the book. It's a very key exception to this. But
yes.
I think what, you know, I do this, I think, a little differently than most people who write essays or do criticism. And I think for most people who do this, what they do is they start with a thesis and then they want to prove it. And they want to persuade people to sort of see the world as they do. And that's not really how I work. I kind of go backwards. Basically, I just write about things that are interesting to me. And then as I work through them, I try to look for things that sort of unify what is the intellectual process behind the sort of emotional reaction. Because I'm always kind of fascinated by the idea of the separation between, rational and emotional, and how actually in many ways that they're just intertwined. So as I wrote this book and I kind of talked about these characters, I started looking for things that sort of connected them in ways outside of their acts. And the thing that I kept kind of coming across was this idea that what really seems to bother people and really makes an audience view someone as a villain is when they see someone who seems to be able to sort of effortlessly manipulate the world. Like they have a real understanding of how people work and what people want and how to get things done. But they have no emotional investment in what those actions end up resulting in. It's almost as though they have the ability to sort of do good or do bad, but they're almost disinterested in what that means. And that forces people or prompts people to look at those acts and place them or frame them as bad.
But are you taking it back that in any such situation, a villain is a person who knows the most but cares the least? Are you saying you were just sort of musing, sort of turning that over in your mind?
Well, nothing is ever so straight as you can say, well, here's a statement that explains why all villains exist. I mean, it's for most of the book. For most of the people written about in the book, that would apply. But I also don't want to act – I mean, it's too easy to sort of come up with a sort of a tight-fitting, good-sounding sort of statement that sort of is the over – that's just not the way – I'm not trying to convince people that I have broken the code here. This is what villains are, you know.
Well, let me quote you because you say here – and perhaps I'm being very concrete. You say the most villainous move any person can make is tying a woman – to the railroad tracks.
Yes.
So are you're standing by that statement?
Well, I mean, this book is also supposed to be funny. I mean, I'd like to, okay, what would literally be the most villainous act? Well, I go through a whole bunch of things. Blowing up a planet, you know, creating genocide, killing children, killing animals. But what I was talking about is sort of the archetype of evil. So I was like, well, you know, when you think about it, you know, when I was a little kid and I saw Snidely Whiplash on the Dudley Do-Right cartoon,
right.
You know. Well, now, of course, as a little kid, I don't realize that this is basically like a distilled version of the history of the silent movie villain or whatever, you know. It's just this idea of what a person with that kind of hat, with that kind of mustache, seemingly doing this impractical act of evil. You know, it's going to kill someone, but very slowly. Wants them to be on the track, to hear the train coming, you know. So I started. I just sort of kind of use that as a jumping off point. I mean, I do not think many people will read that line and go, well, here's his literal point. This book is going to be about tying women to railroad tracks. That's not how it works.
Well, perhaps I'm being literal here, but I think a sentence like that, and perhaps I didn't get the humor there, seems to indicate that there's sort of a hierarchy. You know, that this is the worst thing that someone can do. This is the, you know, the next to worst thing that someone can do. As someone that has written a book about villainy and evil and bad things and bad people, I mean, don't you have to seriously grapple with that?
How seriously do you suggest I should grapple with it?
Well,
how important is it that I forward outside of the entertainment value, outside of the interest value, that I say something that is really definitive about the concept of evil? Do you think that is an essential component?
Well,
you can. I mean, that's totally fine.
No. Well, it seems to me when you're talking about evil, and I think we all try to understand, you know, malevolence and evil, the people that do bad things. I can't tell you how many times I've seen, for instance, documentaries of the Holocaust because I don't understand it. I mean, I do, but I don't understand it. And evil, villainy is a serious issue. I mean, for me, if we could understand it, perhaps we could prevent it. Perhaps we could figure out what to do about it. I mean, it is something about human nature. And perhaps that's not the book that you.
Yeah, it's not. This is maybe a better way to describe it. Okay, I've written 8 books. First few books I wrote, the first book I wrote was like listening to hair metal in the Midwest. It was about like Guns N' Roses and Kiss and Motley Crue and sort of the idea of that kind of music being the soundtrack to someone's life. And then the second book was called Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and that was an essay collection where I was sort of dealing with real sort of consumer culture. You know, TV shows like Saved by the Bell, couldn't that be perceived in an artful way? Or Pamela Anderson, John Cusack movies, things like that. So I write those books, and at the time I thought, well, okay, I feel like these books are sort of filled with ideas about the way culture operates. You know, there are ideas about how audiences view things based on their pre-existing idea of what is supposed to be high and low art and all of these things. But when I was interviewed about those books, of course, people would want to ask me questions about the band Rat, or they'd want to ask me questions about, do I prefer Frosted Flakes to Cocoa Puffs? And that was fine, but at the time I remember thinking, well, this is weird. Sort of like I'm writing about these ideas and people are only interested in the content. Well, now, you know, I'm doing this book about villains, right?
Yes.
And in many ways, it's the same. The level of idea is kind of the same. It's more about mediated culture. It's not an attempt to sort of define what true evil is or how should we feel about evil. But because the actual examples I'm using are different now people ask me these questions like, well, how do we deal with the problem of Pol Pot or like, well, you know, the nature of free will? So now, of course, I'm doing the opposite. I'm like, hey, this is just a book. It's just entertaining. It's supposed to be fun to read. I feel like in many ways the level of discourse is kind of the same throughout the entire trajectory. People just really focus on what the subject is in a real specific way. Mm-hmm. But for me, they're all just sort of thought experiments.
Well, for instance, and I had in my intro, because I took it from the preface to your book, you raise questions about whether you care about strangers. Are you a psychopath? Are you evil? I mean, are these real? I mean, I think we all sort of grapple with our own inner demons. I'm trying to figure out, and we all have evil thoughts, and we all want to get revenge on someone who, you know, does something that we don't like or feels offensive to us. But when you say these are questions you ask yourself, are you really asking yourself, or is it just a thought experiment?
Well, okay, so I'm sitting outside before this interview at the table waiting to do this interview, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, why am I doing this interview? Well, I'm doing this interview basically to kind of promote the event I'm doing at the library tonight. And why am I doing the event at the library tonight? I'm doing the event at the library to sell books. That's really the intention. Okay. But like, this is essentially like a public radio situation.
Sure.
It should be about discourse, right? So I'm thinking to myself, so basically, I found a way to commodify public discourse. Like, I am basically using something that's supposed to be, like a free exchange of ideas for ultimately commercial purposes. I certainly wouldn't be here if I wasn't promoting a book, you know. So I think about these things, and I was like, well, what is my motive for doing that? How problematic is that motive? Is the fact that I'm aware of that motive even worse? Because if I just thought to myself, hey, I wrote a book, they want to talk to me about this book, that's great, you know, it must be important that they want me to talk to you, that, you know, I could convince myself that what I'm actually doing here is, you know, something altruistic. But it's not, okay? So when I look out my window and I say I see strangers and right. I don't care about them, well, I know that the purpose of life is basically engagement with other people. That's the most important – the reason that it is important to be alive is to have some sort of meaningful interaction with other people. And yet I look down and I don't feel anything. And I wonder why. Now, is this a unique thing? Well, it's not that unique. Like you say, everyone grapples with
sure.
this. But – you know, it's to me, as a writer, I'm working through things that are not that separate from the average person, you know?
Well, and it's interesting, as you describe, you know, your I guess your ambivalence about being here, and I totally get it, because I interview a lot of people on book tours, and for me, you know, I don't care about whether you sell books or not, mm-hmm. whether you fill the free
yeah.
library or not. As far as I'm concerned, you know, I want to talk to you on this radio show. So there's an interesting
yes.
kind of tension between the two of us, I
well,
think.
It's not that I don't want to talk about it. I love talking about it. It's really fun. But at the same time, there's a falseness I feel, and I fear that falseness. Right. And I spend, as you've read the book,
yes.
a lot of time worrying about the relationship between consciousness and sort of what makes us be the person that we are, you know, and would a lack of consciousness in some ways make us a better person? But of course, we want consciousness. We desire it. We desire self-awareness, you know.
But what's interesting, I mean, this happens with a lot of people that I interview. I mean, I have never met you before.
Yeah, I haven't met you.
I mean, I read your book. You don't know me. I don't know you. And yet, you know, we sit you down and I pick your brain and I go through your book and I pick out things that speak to me, that make me wonder about mm-hmm. you. And here we are then on top of it, you know, having a public conversation.
Yes.
And I don't know you, and yeah. you don't know me.
Well, that's the great thing about interviewing. That's why it's fun being a journalist. I've always enjoyed that part of like magazine journalism and right. newspaper journalism, the sense that I could immediately ask people questions very often that I really couldn't ask my friends.
Sure.
If I talk to a celebrity, I can ask them intimate details about their reason for being in a relationship. I have very close friends. It would be very uncomfortable to ask that sort of query, you know, because it would you know, there's a certain discomfort when you know someone. But because we don't know each other, that discomfort yeah. is gone, or it actually is good. Like the fact that if people are listening to this interview right
hopefully.
Now and they think that there's like, oh, this seems kind of tense or adversarial, yeah. they like it more. So we should probably actually foster that.
We probably should.
Yeah. But now our awareness that we should do that makes the
exactly.
whole thing fake. Yeah. So like if we keep arguing in this fake way, it will be good for radio and we'll both be sort of betraying people.
Well, speak for yourself, because yeah. I'm not faking it here, but we do need to take a very short break. Chuck Klosterman is our guest today on Radio Times. You might read him in the New York Times Magazine. In fact, he writes the Ethicist column for the magazine, hired about a year ago, and he's written a number of books, including most recently the one we're talking about is called I Wear the Black Hat, and it's subtitled Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. Much more after this very short break. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Alzheimer's is not curable, but prescription medications can sometimes help to maintain the quality of life for longer periods. Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a research study to test a new investigational medication for patients with a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 610-277-8073. 610-277-8073 or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
Wasps and hornets are a scary sight, but does a lot of wasps always mean an increased risk of stings? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a close look at some of nature's most fascinating and frightening looking creatures, plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, with a new study showing Americans are driving less, an urban planner wants cities to rethink the focus on cars and parking.
Why do we have this system where as long as you have a car, you get to occupy 120 square feet of valuable land for free?
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, Chuck Klosterman is our guest today on the show. He's now the author of 8 books, and that includes 2 novels, the newest one called I Wear the Black Hat, grappling with villains real and imagined. He writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine and is speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia, obviously joining us today on Radio Times. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Now I'm afraid of quoting you out of your own book because you're going to come back at me. But you do write about Newt Gingrich as an interesting person to explore under this sort of rubric of possible villainy.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm a pretty apolitical person, but I'm not, you know, I don't certainly side very closely with most of Newt Gingrich's policies. Yet when I see him in public, when I see him talking, there's something very charming is not the right word, and amusing is maybe the wrong word too. But I there's something about him that I feel as though I see an element of myself in. You know, it's like he'll come up with a sort of a crazy idea, like we should, you know, eliminate child labor laws. But it doesn't seem so crazy because he also wants to colonize the moon, and it seems like he works only in like a paradigm of ideas. He doesn't even necessarily think about how they would apply to people, but he likes, like, you know, we're talking about thought experiments. He seems to love thought experiments, you know. He seems to love sort of saying, well, the world operates this way, but what if we did this thing that falls in line with the political ideology and is sort of outside the framework of how we've always run the world? I find that very interesting to me, and I find myself somehow rooting for him, even though I would not like his success in terms of how it would actually apply to the lives of people. You know, it's almost like he's not even a real person.
Well, you quote XXX Sex Pistol vocalist John Lydon telling Rolling Stone, I've had the pleasure of meeting Newt Gingrich and having a chat with a fellow on a staircase. I found him completely dishonest and totally likable because he doesn't care.
Well, and the thing is, it's a great quote because not only does it define Newt Gingrich pretty successfully, it's also the highest compliment one can get from a member of the Sex Pistols. It's almost like the platonic idea of how like Johnny Rotten would want the world to take his art, you know.
Is there something compelling, though, about someone, you know, full of ideas but doesn't care?
That's what the villain is, sort of this person who, not in totality, but very often, that the person who has, you know, the potential to sort of change the world in some way, and you know, it's not even that they're electing to do something negative. It's almost though that they don't even see the extension of that. Like Lee Atwater is a great example. Okay, there's this documentary called Boogeyman about Lee Atwater. I wish I'd written about him in the book. I've thought about it but never did. But there was something from this documentary that that really galvanizes this. They're talking about his early days getting into politics. And the biggest decision he made was arbitrary, which was to basically become a Republican. Mm-hmm. He looked at the framework of politics in the 70s, and he was like, well, I can get more traction on the right. Now, there's somebody who really understood the way politics work, okay? He, in many times in the worst possible way, the most almost diabolical way. But for him, it was just sort of like a toss of the coin. Like the biggest single decision he made was the one that mattered the least to him. And everything else, the machinations of politics, was just something he could effortlessly do.
Why does that interest you, though?
Well, why does it interest me? That's actually a very good question. I mean, because it's sort of like, you know, you can say like, well, any personality is interesting, but why did it interest me enough to write a book is the question, I guess. I think it's because, you know, you You look at art, for example, you know, idioms of art, and the idea of the antihero. Well, you know, in film, we see this in the 70s. You know, when the auteur movement is happening, you know, suddenly you see that's those films by Jack Nicholson during that period and The Godfather. And this idea now that these, you know, the apex of American film often involved heroes that seemed like villains. And then in the 80s and the 90s, you certainly saw this with rock music and hip hop that became the iconography that a musician takes if they want to seem like a youth-oriented sort of artist. In television, we really see that beginning with The Sopranos, that, you know, David Chase is making this show, he's nervous. That, you know, will people accept this character who's technically a criminal? Not only do they accept it, they totally embrace it. Now, if you're making high-end television, you know, if you're making The Wire or Breaking Bad or Mad Men or whatever, it's almost essential that you have a hero that's problematic. And, you know, what I think this really is when you hear the cliche of someone saying, I watched this movie and the villain was more interesting than the hero, I think what they're actually saying is the villain was more real than the hero. And I think that this is what this thing that I'm sort of working through in this book, the same thing many people are working through, that as an adult, when you're a mature person, you're not aspiring to be like a character. You're looking to see yourself in it. And for whatever reason, and I guess that's what the book is about, the many reasons that the reality of ourselves can be seen in the problematic person more lucidly. You know, the heroes seem, you know, naive and impossible. Yeah.
I don't mean this question as an insult, but do you think of yourself as an adult?
As an adult?
Yeah. Well, as you said, when you're an adult, you begin to think about these things in different kinds of ways. You even talk about Star Wars, you know, how men, young men, sort of how they relate to the characters as they become adults.
Well, I mean, I'm 41.
Right.
I pay taxes.
Right.
Do I feel like I'm I don't feel like I'm an adult.
Because I don't always feel like an adult.
Well, I don't feel like an adult the way I think other people do because I don't have a real job. You know, I kind of get to do for a job what other people would do for entertainment. Because of that, I don't feel the way I feel like, you know, my dad was a farmer. I think that he thought about his life very differently than I do because I had the luxury sort of to do this, to have these, to sort of, you know, ask what is reality and like write a book about what is reality. You know, that's not a very, to me, like adult pursuit, even though you need to be an adult to do it, you know.
Well, and going back to even, and again, I'm quoting you again, your editor saying to you, you wanted to write this book because you're afraid you're actually a villainous person. I mean, was he correct about that?
Yes.
And did this book help you? I mean, I'm not saying it's a self-help book, but did this help?
not a self-help book.
This is clearly not a self-help book. But did this writing sort of help you think through some of those maybe of yourself?
You know, okay. Example I often use about this is that, you know, your mind is like a ball of yarn. All the ideas in it are pre-existing. They're in your head, but they're all knotted up and wound together. And then writing is like straightening of that out, straightening the string out. I mean, I'm not in any way comparing myself to George Orwell. One thing George Orwell says is that he didn't really understand how he felt about something until he wrote about it. And I definitely relate to that sort of sentiment, okay? So, you know, do I have a better understanding of myself than before I wrote the book? You know, probably not. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things about this book, I think I mentioned this in the book to a degree. When I was 21, I did not know what I would be doing in 20 years. But I certainly thought life would be more rational, more sensible. I would understand the world better. And of course, the opposite has happened. Like, I understand life now less at 41 than I did at 21. And I assume at 61, it'll be less, you know, even less.
Because the more you know, the less you understand?
I think that when you're a young person or intellectually young, however you want to look at it, you have less flexible ideas, you know, and that if you have a, you know, clear ideas about politics and clear ideas about how to live and a real defined ethical framework, it makes life much easier. And as you grow older, the blackness and whiteness of life totally disappear and you live in a life that's just wholly gray. And then as you grow older, it goes more and more gray. Now, many people are listening to this who are my age or older, and they're like, of course, everyone knows this. But, you know, the difference is, like, I write, you know, I'm kind of a humorist and a critic and stuff, so I write about my life and my experiences sort of as they happen. If you read all 8 of my books in a row, it's kind of like one big book.
And the book we are talking about, or the book that our guest has most recently authored, is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. He is Chuck Klosterman, and he has written a number of books, including 2 novels, and he currently writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I don't know if this is ancient history for you, something you wrote for Esquire, gosh, back in 2004, the importance of being hated. And you talk about what you need is one quality nemesis and one arch enemy. These are the 2 most important characters in the life of a successful human. We measure ourselves against our nemeses, and we long to destroy our arch enemies. Does that still fit for you?
Well, I mean, that was a humor column.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, I'm not – that, first of all, that column's also mentioned in this book in the last essay. We talk about that specific idea.
Right.
But, you know, does it still apply? Well, I mean, in the broadest possible sense, yes. But these are not like a rule book for living. I mean, I mean, are you asking, like, do I still feel that it's important to have an archenemy and a nemesis? Well, for entertainment reasons, yes. Like, this, you know, it's like this book is supposed to be fun to read. I think you're misinterpreting what the motive behind this book might be.
And why do you think that? I mean, that could be my fault.
No, I don't think it's anyone's fault. It's, you know, okay, when I write anything, I have 3 goals. I want it to be interesting, I want it to be entertaining, and I want it to be clear. I want it to be interesting in the sense that if someone's thinking about themselves or thinking about the world, they sort of see a different kind of view. They don't have to necessarily change their mind, but they're like, well, here's a different way to sort of think about problems. I like to be entertaining in the sense that the experience of reading is fun and that the person says, like, well, you know, I invested some time in this and it was a pleasurable experience. And I want to be clear in the sense that I want the sentence structure to be a communicative art. I want people to be able to move from the beginning of the sentence to the end of the sentence and feel like they understood what I was saying. Mm-hmm. Now, it would strike me that 3rd quality did not so much happen with you because I don't think that. But that's fine. That's cool. You know.
Well, I think it's fair to say, I'll be honest with you, is that I didn't get what you were saying in this book. Well, and perhaps, again, I'm being too concrete. I'm too humorless, I guess as an interviewer, you know, I'm looking. What is this person trying to tell me? And I don't know what it is.
Well, it's a tough question.
It is a tough question. It is a tough question.
Yeah.
And is that? I mean, do you feel like you need to answer that for me, or we just sort of we can let it hang out there?
Do I need to answer what I was getting at with this book that you have read?
Yes.
No, I don't have to answer that. I mean, if you don't like it, that's fine. I'm not trying to persuade you.
And I'm curious about whether you read reviews of the. Do you read reviews of your book?
Of course.
Right. Because I have to say, I'm not alone. I mean, and this is, it was in, because I always read reviews of people that have written books just to kind of see what other people are saying.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that I'm right and you're wrong, but I don't think I'm the only one that doesn't understand what you're
saying. Sure.
Yeah. And that's okay.
Yeah. Well, because I'm not, here again, I'm not trying to persuade people who don't like the book to like it. You write books for the people who want them. You write books for yourself in a lot of ways, you know?
Let me get some callers in. It looks like we have Donna from Pennington, New Jersey. And Donna, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm
really
good.
Enjoying this conversation.
Good.
Because I'm writing a novel, and I just submitted it to an agent, and he suggested that my villain is not likable enough. And I have been thinking about this. Does a villain actually need to be someone with whom readers can identify? And I'm just wondering what you think of that.
That's a good question, Donna. Go ahead, Chuck.
Well, I mean, you know, there was a time when the thing an agent would come back to you or an editor might come back to you and say is that, you know, your protagonist isn't likable enough. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that they would say your villain isn't likable enough. The advice I would give to you is, you know, the character needs to be an extension of what you want that character to do and what that you want them to be, how you want them to sort of exist in your mind. So I would say, you know, what does the character in your book do, the villain?
She is a perfect mother with a perfect life, and she is kind of lording it over her neighbors who are not perfect.
Oh, that sounds pretty evil to me, Donna. Chuck?
Yeah. Well,
thank you.
Your agent feels like the person should have more charm, maybe. She should be a more charming person in that position.
Yes, or not. What actually she opens the novel. It's written, it's told in two different monologues, and two different interior monologues, and he feels that people won't be immediately engaged by this interior kind of villainous voice.
Well, I mean, I guess this is just like kind of just straightforward advice. One way they off, you know, I'm not the first person who said this, is if you want to make a fictional character more likable to the reader, put them in a situation where they are humiliated. People will immediately sort of sense, you know, they will relate to that idea of times in their life where they have felt that particular emotion and the discomfort of that, and they will kind of inject themselves into the character. So, if that's what you're looking for, that's the way to do it. But I would suggest don't do something just because someone told you that this will make the book better. You know, they might be right, they might be wrong. In 50 years, the only person who's going to really care about your book are you. Is you. You know, for me, it's for everyone like that. You know, unless you're in that rarefied class of genius that your book lives on forever. For the most part, you know, you write a book, people respond to it, but you have to be the person who feels good about it because you'll be the one seeing it on your shelf forever.
You know? Donna, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and good luck with that as well. Let me just pick up on, you talked about the sort of golden age of movies when we had these anti-heroes, and I think we're kind of in the golden age of television now. And when you think about, you mentioned Tony Soprano, I'm thinking of Breaking Bad, you know, Walter White. There's a new show, I'm still trying to get used to it, Ray Donovan on TV. Again, these are anti-heroes. And we are sort of intrigued by their problems. We watch them do bad things. We watch them relate to others. And it touches so many different emotions. I think it's sort of fascinating to watch. And even to watch our own reaction to these people.
I guess it's kind of hard to do. But are these characters fascinating? Well, certainly. I mean, these are the best shows on television.
Indeed.
When you talk about, you know, how television has changed, there was a long period where I don't think any showrunner would have put forward a character that would have the potential to be hated by an objective audience member. And now that's sort of essential, you know.
Well, and we're all summing a break here, but it's interesting to go, you know, from the father knows best kind of dad to the doofus dad of like Homer Simpson, and now you've got these other kinds of fathers.
Like what are you talking? Like what example are you talking about? Like Walter White, for example.
Sure.
I suppose, you know, he has kids, he is a father, although that show's not really about, it's about his familial relationship. It started that way, certainly, because, you know, when you enter Breaking Bad from the first episode, you're seeing it through the eyes of a character who is almost seemingly wholly good.
Yeah.
That he has cancer, and he wants to do something to save his family from the life that they're going to have when he is gone, and he's got to do this terrible thing in order to make that happen. And then, of course, what's interesting is the evolution of that character is that he enjoys the process of being bad.
And that's Chuck Klosterman, our guest today on Radio Times, author of a new book called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. We should talk about, after this short break, the fact that he now writes the ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9444. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm bringing Facebook back. Yeah! Tech-savvy Vietnamese Americans are helping bloggers in Vietnam who face a government crackdown.
The security officer watch me and follow me everywhere I go.
The Vietnamese immigrants provide tips on evading government snoops.
Nobody will know that it is me looking at information on the web.
Helping bloggers in Vietnam stay connected on PRI's The World.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
Bioethicist Peggy Batten, an advocate of the right to die, has been wrestling with the issue in her own family. Her husband was in an accident, leaving him with quadriplegia and on life-supporting technology. We'll talk with her on the next Fresh Air. And as Detroit files for bankruptcy, Bruce Katz will describe promising signs of renewal in American cities. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Is it a bridge too far for the NSA's war on terror? Will domestic surveillance sink the Patriot Act?
When the American people find out how their government has interpreted the Patriot Act, they are going to be angry.
Senator Ron Wyden, one of the congressional critics out to undo the Patriot Act, next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Chuck Klosterman is our guest. He's the author now of 8 books, the newest one called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. He has been a columnist for Esquire and Spin, and most recently hired by the New York Times Magazine to write the Ethicist column. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Why covering a lot of territory in this hour of Radio Times. Let me see what looks like Ross from Cherry Hill has to say. Ross, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, it's a big fan for a long time of both of you.
Thanks.
And I understand you both sort of kind of. So quick question for Chuck about his work on Grantland.
Sure.
I find that some of the writing on there, even in our culture where we're expected to, you know, move on from point to point and kind of forget the whole general picture, his work. There was an essay even on the fact that John Paul Jones had a phone on top of his keyboard during a Led Zeppelin concert in one of the concert films, and the writing was just amazing in the moment, which I guess the best thing you can say about writers who do expository writing is they illustrate that moment and kind of explore it, and I guess Chuck gave a couple of different ideas of what really could have been going on with the phone and that sort of thing, and I found that really remarkable.
Thank you.
And also I'd like to bring up our generation. We've kind of had athletes who are bad guys because of their doping, whereas previous generations it might have been a problem, but it wasn't as obvious. And I wanted to ask Chuck about his idea of a bad guy, of someone like a Ryan Braun, who seems on the outside more, you know, down to earth and a hard worker as compared to A-Rod, who has been known to be a doper for a while.
Thanks for the call, Ross. Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Well, you know, peds are, you know, it's this inflexible wall that we've sort of made this collective decision about that, okay, that, you know, certain improvements with athletics we readily adopt, whether it has to do with just shoes, weight training, nutrition, all of these things. They all seem like a natural extension of someone getting better. And then there's the idea of supplements, and we agree that supplements seem to be acceptable. But then there's this class of drugs that we just, you know, put the wall up. But now we keep hitting this wall with different people, and I do feel as though that this argument that we're having over steroids, I don't think this argument is going to be ongoing. I think in 25 or 30 years, we're going to look back at this period and say, like, well, this was, you know, we were really grappling with this idea of the level playing field. And, you know, why do we watch sports? Do we watch sports for some kind of purity? Are we watching it for entertainment? You know, that's the most interesting thing, like something like Ryan Braun brings up, is the idea is that when people are upset with his actions? What are they upset by? They're certainly not upset because performance-enhancing drugs are affecting his play in a negative way. They're upset that it's affecting his play in a positive way. And somehow that makes us think that, well, what we're watching needs to be acceptable both to an adult but also to a 9-year-old and maybe to a 90-year-old. It's got to be this collective universal thing. So, I mean, like, is he a villain because he used steroids? Well, he's unpopular for it. I don't know if he's a villain.
Ross, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Can I segue from that to a really interesting part of your book where you talk about the Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, first of all, there are two personalities, the way that Muhammad Ali just goaded Frazier. Frazier, of course, having Philadelphia roots here. How you see or saw their relationship? What does that tell us?
Well, that's from a section in the book about people who have done villainous things but are not villains at all. Like Muhammad Ali is not a villain as far as the world is concerned. He is probably the most important athlete in terms of civil rights of the 20th century, even more so than Jackie Robinson. But they had that very strange, you know, three-fight trajectory with Frazier. Probably the three greatest heavyweight battles between two guys, history of the sport. And yet, Ali's actions within that spectrum are just – it's insane, the racial invective he used. And, he pretty much tried to position Frazier as a black boxer representing the white populace, you know, and it was just so unlike the person Joe Frazier was. And yet, this has been erased. Like, we don't factor this in to – it's not that people don't know that Ali did this. It's not like this is some big secret. We just don't use it as part of the criteria for, you know, judging him as a person. I compare it similarly to, you know, like John Lennon had many problematic relationships with women. He said his own kids have claimed that John Lennon hit women, you know. But as Beatles fans, like I'm a Beatles fan, we don't even want to factor this in. We don't even want to consider that. We want, you know, and it's the idea of what choices, what parts of history are removed for our sort of comfort, you know?
Let me see what Gail from Hampton, New Jersey has to say. Gail, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that the author talked about, you know, wishing evil on your nemesis or people that have done bad things, particularly people that have done bad things to, you know, yourself. I think that's common nature, that it isn't necessarily that I want to really see something manifested on someone that's hurt me, but the idea of it appeals to me.
The idea of revenge.
And I do think that's that's normal. You seemed, Marty, to be a little put off by that idea, but I don't know. I can relate to it. Incident.
I can totally relate to sort of revenge fantasies. I mean, I think I was talking about that, but go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think I was talking about revenge. Right. There's not much about. I mean, I'm not the idea of having, you know, an emotional reaction to someone who hurts you. Is that, you know, revenge is the act. Revenge isn't the sense of it. You know. But I suppose that is, it's a normal thing. I don't think that's groundbreaking. But yeah.
Gail, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You've been the ethicist columnist, I guess, for about a year now.
Mm-hmm.
What have you learned in the last year? I mean, it's an interesting window into people's, I guess, their struggles with trying to figure out whether how to do the right thing, whether they're a good person or not?
Well, whether or not they're a good person, that's actually a lot of the questions that I end up ultimately not using because they're not really ethical quandaries. You know, you get a lot of questions in there. It's a very fun job. It's an incredibly interesting job, you know. But very often somebody will pose a question that is built around the idea that, you know, something happened in the interior of their mind. They were on a train and they didn't sit by a certain person. Right. And they're wondering, does that mean that they're racist or sexist or classist or something, you know? But ethics really begin when it starts involving other people, you know? And that's sort of what I'm always looking for in these questions. A small problem, and, you know, kind of like a non-fictional you know, thought experiment, thought problem that can apply to many different things. You're looking for the core question within, the specifics of a problem. Yeah.
But I'm curious about the answer. I mean, you have to respond to these questions. Mm-hmm. We read them in the Times. Is it just sort of thinking it through yourself, as you said? You know, as you write, you're taking all these sort of tangled threads and then pulling them out straight. Are you consulting books?
The advantage that someone who's writing a column about problems has is emotional distance. That they're not in the scenario, basically feeling the pull of all these different forces on them. So you can look at the problem. You can say like, well, okay, here's an ethical framework to use. Here's what a rational person would do in that. Now, I fully realize that that's easier said than done. Sometimes I have thought to myself, well, if I was in this situation, would I be able to follow my own advice? But that's not the job of. That's not kind of my job. My job is to look at it and say, like, this is an ethical response, not to say I'm the most ethical person and this is what I would do. That's the most confusing thing about that column.
I bet.
Yeah, that people sort of think that you are arguing that you're the most ethical person in New York, and I would not make that argument.
Well, I wonder if it should be called something else besides the ethicist column.
Well, if they called it the advisor, okay, that would make people more comfortable, but that's a semantic issue. It would be exactly the same. I mean, it's still ultimately a newspaper column, you know?
But it is interesting to give advice knowing that – and I realize you're not giving advice. You're just helping people think through something, because I do believe that most people don't take advice, even well-intentioned advice that's given, because if they did, I think the world would probably be a better place.
Well, I mean, not just that. Okay, I get a question from the ethicist. Maybe, you know, maybe it's a week till I get to it. It takes a week to work on it.
Right.
That's 2 weeks.
Right.
Then you turn it into the editor. It's another – so it's 3 weeks since I received it. So the idea that someone is posing a problem to a newspaper in order to actually respond immediately, that's not really how it works. It's really for the other people, the person outside of the problem who's reading the column as an audience, opposed to, if somebody writes me a question and they're like, something's happening today, I need to know today, well, then I will just respond directly to them.
Yeah, But how do you – is there a way that you – are there ones that sort of rise to the top when you pick which one you're actually going to write about?
Oh, certainly. So, I mean, it's the questions that I'm most interested in are things that the problem the person dealing with is not strictly tied to the situation they're in. It's a problem that many people are going to be in under many different contexts. But here's a good example. It's like, everyone's been in a situation like this. Here's a real one,
Were you a writer as a kid?
Yes.
I mean, as a young kid, was it a matter of being an early reader, early writer? Did you have teachers in school that saw that you had writing abilities?
Well,
encouraged?
It was a different thing. I mean, I came from a much different place. Like I was talking before we got on the air, like there was 23 kids in my class. It was very rural. I mean, the idea of becoming a writer wasn't really a reasonable thing. I was interested in high school in reading and in journalism. So I majored in journalism. The goal at the time was, just to maybe one day, if everything worked out perfectly and I worked really hard and I got better, I could maybe end up at the Minneapolis Star Tribune or, the Detroit Free Press or something, just at a major daily newspaper, So it's interesting how things actually have worked out.
Yeah. And as you look back, does it make sense how you ended up where you are? Does it make sense to you?
Yeah, well, this is the most obvious thing about life. It's like while it's happening, it seems chaotic, it seems crazy, it seems as though things are happening spontaneously. And then when you look back on life, it seems like this completely well-crafted story that made total sense. I mean, that's just how it is for everyone. Yeah.
And when you go home, I mean, is your home where you grew up, how different does it look today from when you were a kid? Or maybe it looks the same?
Well, it looks more the same than most communities would. I mean, New York in the 11 years I've lived there has changed more than my hometown has changed since 1975 or 72 or 1980 or any of those periods,
And in your high school yearbook, did you have one high school, 23 kids? Did it have, most likely to do blah, blah, blah?
No, we didn't have that. Just a picture.
Just a picture.
Yeah.
Let me see what looks like Marguerite from Media has to say. Marguerite, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, guys. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning.
I just have a quick a question for your guest. And about 15 years ago, my son received the first Harry Potter book as a birthday gift. I didn't understand what the hoopla was about. And I decided to pick it up one morning, and I did not put it down. I didn't eat. I didn't drink. I didn't do anything until I finished that book. What is it about that series and that particular first book that captivated everyone? I was captivated myself, and I just don't know why. And as relates to your villain and heroes, and I was just wondering why that book is pure gold.
Did you read those books?
Well, I did not, but I think I can still probably give an answer to that question. You know, the things that happen in, you know, whether it's Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, anything kind of in YA literature, like you see that in many books, in many iterations of those of these kinds of books. It really is the writing. I mean, there's this, you know, J.K. Rowling just recently published, published a book under a pseudonym, a kind of a crime novel, and you know, it only sold like 1500 copies, but the reviews were all good. And then there was this recognition that she had written it. Now it's like a bestseller. But you know, there is, with any kind of art, there's a certain magical aspect to it, an intangible thing that, you know, voice. The most important thing about writing is voice, and yet it's the one quality that cannot be taught or learned. Mm-hmm. It just sort of exists. It seems like an unfair thing that the most important thing, it's like, you know, is like almost like being able to jump high or something, like it just exists. And yet, like, she has it. Like, she had, like, when you say that you were sucked into it, what you're describing is the propulsive nature of the way she, you know, set up the plot mm-hmm. mechanics and the word choice and the fact that it seemed real to you in some way, even though it was you know, completely fictional. I mean, it's impossible to explain. If someone could explain it, somebody would be very rich.
Marguerite, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're almost out of time here, but do you have a certain ways that you write or schedules of writing? Some people are more haphazard. Some are very sort of disciplined. They sit themselves down at a certain time and then they're done at a certain time. Do you have any of those?
You know, I just kind of sit down and do it. You know, it's like if I was a musician, for example, there's two kinds of musicians, many kinds, but two big kinds,
right?
Classically trained and people who just kind of play by feel. And if I was a musician, I guess I would be in the second category. I mean, I didn't go to graduate school. I just write. I just like writing. It's fun. There's something about it that makes sense to me when I do it, and when I think about what I want to write, kind of in the back of my mind, constantly, and then at one point I just sit down and just knock it out, just do it.
Well, Chuck Klosterman, thank you. Klosterman, excuse me. Thank you very much for joining us. And our guest has been Chuck Klosterman. The book is I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. Jessica Crocker, our intern for today's edition of the show. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder with Emily Bryant. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.